time.
When we moved to reformed in Dorset, initially as infantry, the commanding officer was Colonel Edwards. He had served in the Great War and had an Air Force Cross. The adjutant was Captain Irvine, I-R-V-I-N-E, and he was a territorial officer, and he had taken over adjutant shortly after the outbreak of war from the one regular officer who was always posted to a territorial regiment, which was Captain Brooke Webb.
Now, what were these two, Edwards and Irvine, what were they actually like as people, if you could give us an idea, to give us a picture of them?
Well, I didn't see very much of the colonel, because in a very short time he was replaced by a more active regular officer. But the adjutant I had got to know very well.
What was he like?
He was a solicitor from Stockton on Tees, and obviously the solicitor skills were there. He was he could get rather aggressive at times, particularly if he'd had one or two many drinks, and we had to watch him a little bit. But he was a very nice and very brave chap.
You said the colonel was replaced for a more active officer. Was he not so active then? You see what I mean? I'm not looking for criticism of him, but was he...
Well, as assistant adjutant, which I'd just been appointed, a conference was called for all the commanding officers of units over a wide range by Montgomery. I, as the assistant adjutant, went to fetch my colonel back from this conference, which had lasted a couple of days, and we were allowed to hear Montgomery's summing up, which was really quite breathtaking. And also behind him was sitting his superior general, Auchinleck, who was then in charge of Southern Command.
Now, what was it that was breathtaking about Montgomery?
It was his style of address, his certainty about everything, and his laying down on the line quite strict tenets. For example, he said everybody, including up to the commanding officer, must run 5 miles a week. And I could see that a number of the territorial regimental officers really weren't up to this, and that probably my CO would go. And he did, in fact, was superseded and transferred to another job a few weeks later, and our new commanding officer was a regular soldier, Lieutenant Colonel Dewing, D-E-W-I-N-G.
Now, what was Dewing like? How did he? What did you think of him?
He was a gunnery expert. He'd been trained on the ranges at Lark Hill. He came with a very small suitcase, which is the instructors in gunnery used to put their sandwiches in when they went out for the day on the ranges at Lark Hill. And he had everything in his head and in this little suitcase. And he was an expert on gunnery, just in fact what the regiment needed to sharpen up for active service and for the changes which were taking place after the BEF.
Now, could you take us through some of these changes, and both theoretical in gunnery and equipment? Because where we left you, you had 205mm guns captured from the Germans, and that was it.
That was it.
Now, so take us through what happened over the next year or so.
We were infantry for a couple of months. Then we received 75mm guns, which had been sent from America. It was a standard French gun issued to their expeditionary force in the First World War. They had iron wheels and they couldn't proceed any faster than 7.5 miles in the hour on the road. Eventually we got them pneumatized when we could go a bit faster.
Now, what did you think of those guns? Because they had a very good reputation in the First World War, the French 75s.
The trouble is, they were outdated. They were very much almost direct fire weapons, and they had a short range. But the gun itself worked perfectly well.
So what happened next?
After the pneumatized version, and
by pneumatized you mean pneumatic tires?
Tires. That's right. After that, we eventually got 25 pounders, but our role of holding the beach while the threat of invasion was there was finished, and the regiment was moved in late November, I think, to Tiverton in Devon to be a mobile formation in reserve. As regards the gunnery, all the paraphernalia of stage 1, 2 and 3 went out of the window, and it was simply a question of dropping the guns into action and making them ready to fire on rough survey within minutes.
So what do you mean by rough survey? If you...
Well, map spotting, compass. This was up to the gun position officer, then the command post officer of the battery coordinated the two troops, or three troops in his battery, and then finally the regimental survey officer tied in the batteries so that the whole of the regimental guns were firing as one. And the whole procedure was as quick as it could be done. And very satisfactory.
Were there any other new gun procedures or gun things? I know you weren't on the gun end, you were at the command post end most of the time, but anything else that you were aware of that was changing? New techniques?
Well, when we got to Tiverton, we took our guns initially, I think we still had the 75s, and then finally we got with the 25 pounders twice to ranges at Okehampton. And fired them there, and everybody was polished up, and there was a degree of necessity about this. But by the time we'd finished with these two practices, then we were near ready to go into action satisfactorily.
And what did you think of the new 25 pounds? They were the gun howitzers. What did you think of them?
Well, we were very, very pleased to have them. And with the range and everything, we had yet to fire them in anger. And in fact, it was some time before we did fire them in anger. But it was a very satisfactory.
What was better about them? What was so good about it? Because the 25-pounder had a very good reputation. What was so good about it?
Well, the 75mm, for example, top range was 6,600. You could get a bit more yardage if you dug the trail in. The 25-pounder on charge 3 was, I think, 11,400 yards, and on supercharge was about 13,000 yards.
So range, that was better. Better rate of fire?
I wouldn't say the rate of fire was better, but the handling of the gun was. A metal platform was fixed underneath the trail, and this was dropped into action. Then the gun was pulled back onto this platform and enabled the gun crew, the number one, to swivel his gun very quickly, if a new target or range was called for.
And what? And of course, it had a bigger shell. Well, certainly than the 18-pounder, obviously. Was it noticeably more hitting power?
It's not very much bigger than the 75. The 75. To compare, the 25-pounder was very nearly 88 millimetres. So that's your comparison in the size of shell. The 75 had fixed ammunition, therefore it's one big thing with the brass cartridge case which you pushed up the breech. The 25-pounder had a split charge, and you could change the charges, the charge bags, from charge 1, 2 and 3, and supercharge. Also, we carried in the limbers 8 rounds of armour-piercing shot, which was for anti-tank action.
Now, so what happened next then? You went to Tibet in November.
That's right. And we were there until May of the next year. We did several exercises. I remember particularly one on Exmoor. And
what do you remember about that?
Well, as the assistant adjutant, it was, I had to ride a motorbike, and the system was to carry orders back from the divisional headquarters to the regiments.
So acting as a sort of liaison.
I was a high-powered dispatch rider. The exercise took place in January. It was very cold that winter with snow on the ground, and 151 Brigade defended Exmoor against the rest of the division, who were then in the role of an advance to contact. I remember carrying my the orders from RA headquarters at Div, at the brigade, to the regiment, and I thought, what would happen if I just fell off the motorbike and didn't get there? But that was the form at that moment, and I remember sleeping in a hedge in full kit in the middle of the night in the snow, and after it I developed a throat infection and had to go to the hospital at Exeter to get over this, and received the first dose, or one of the first doses, of M&B, which helped very much in the situation.
Was M&B an early penicillin? Or,
no.
Or
something in Baker. It was an antibiotic which was introduced about this time.
And did it work?
It did work. made me very sick, but I could still just see the nurse at the end of the bed. And then we come to May, the regiment really on its toes by now, and we were under orders to go to the Middle East.
Now, what preparations were made for the trip out to the Middle East? I mean, in the sense of equipment, uniform preparations, embarkation leave, anything like that?
Well, we had a tropical kit issued.
But what was it? What was tropical kit?
Well, you had a fairly substantial shirt with sleeves. We had shorts. They were called long shorts, very ungainly, because they, in the turned-up position, they were shorts. Then you turn this down, which is then supposed to tuck into the top of your stocking hose, so, as an anti-mosquito deterrent. What happened, of course, in practice was the buttons all came off the thing that held the turn-up, and in the end, everybody cut them down to shorts when we got out to the Middle East.
Did you have any special kit?
We were issued with Woolsey topies, still in those days.
What did you think of them?
Well, they're very effective, but very old-fashioned, and we just almost threw them away when we got to the Middle East. We wouldn't be seen dead in them.
What sort of kit did you have as an officer? You know, an officer's kit, a specialist kit.
Well, it's simply that as an artillery officer, you have to carry compass and binoculars. So you'd have a binocular case, and an officer was traditionally then issued with a pistol. So you had a 3.8 pistol in a holster on one side.
What about personal kit, a valise or that sort of thing?
I had a bedroll and also a camp bed, folding camp bed. But That was it. You put your bed inside the bedroll and rolled it up, and that was what you were allowed.
Did you get any embarkation leave?
Yes. 48 hours, I think, which enabled... I went back to my home in London, and that was it. We just simply knew we were embarking. We didn't know where from. We didn't know where we were going, but we guessed.
Now, tell us about the trip across then to the Middle East.
Well, this was quite interesting. We got to up to Glasgow and by train, and when we detrained, we found, unfortunately, that the local dockers had decided not to work the cranes. The engineers detachment was working the cranes, and soldiers had to load the ship, which was stationed right up close to the bridges in Glasgow. We were the last ship loading, and we could see the other ships right down at, I think it's called the tail of the bank, where the boom was and where the convoys would leave. It was a big convoy, the victorious aircraft carrier and a battle cruiser, which I think was HMS Repulse. And just about this time, the Bismarck came out into the Atlantic. The first thing that happened was our ship was going down to join the convoy, having been loaded at the last minute. The result was she went down on the half tide. One of the crossing ferries from south to north on the river cut across her bows. She had to give way, and we went aground. And so we watched the convoy sail that evening without us. We then had about 10 or 12 days in the estuary, in the river. We were allowed ashore only a couple of times to take a bath, a shower, and they wouldn't initially open the bar because we weren't outside the 3-mile limit. After negotiation, a ration was settled, one bottle of beer per man and a couple of whiskies or spirit drink for the officers.
Now, I should have asked you, what was the name of the ship before we go on?
She was the Duchess of Bedford, CPR boat, one of four of her type. The reason we went aground was she had a lesser draft in order to get up to the St. Lawrence and not hit the bottom. And that was a very comfortable boat and stocked up to pre-war conditions. And we embarked 3,500 on her.
Now, what were conditions like on board for you as an officer and for the men?
Congested. There were 3,500 on board this 25,000-ton liner. But the food was excellent. We did PT in the mornings, but this was all worked out because there were so many troops. You had your half hour on one portion of the deck, and that was it. And the Bismarck at this time had been engaged and sunk, and when we sailed, we had the cruiser, HMS Norfolk, as one of our escorts, and the victorious aircraft carrier, right the way down to the neighbourhood of Gibraltar, because there was still a German 8-inch gun cruiser, the Prince Eugen, loose in the Atlantic at that time. After 4 weeks, we got to Cape Town and had 3 days there, which was very pleasant.
What do you remember of that?
I had foolishly allowed my name to go forward to the rugby team to play the cruiser's rugby team, which was our escort, when we got to Cape Town. We didn't reckon with the month at sea, and we played in the winter there, and I think we were all leaning on each other in the end. Our legs had more or less gone. The men were looked after excellently by the inhabitants, the ladies of Cape Town. They didn't take officers. We had to sort ourselves out. We then had another 4 weeks before we got up to Suez, calling briefly at the port in Kenya. And
Mombasa?
Yes, it's the port for Kilindini. That's the port, Kilindini. Port for Mombasa. We didn't go ashore. And we got to Suez in the middle of July.
Very top port Suez, would it be?
Port Said.
Port Said.
No, it's Suez. Suez at the southern end of the Suez Canal. And as we came up, we were greeted with a rather distressing sign, which was another liner. It was, I think, the Georgic, 32,000 ton motor vessel, and she had been hit by German bombers, was slightly listing on one side, and was in a damaged condition. So the orders to our ship was to go down, turn back down the Red Sea again, and come back in the morning. And we disembarked the next day, because the Germans did put bombers over the Suez Canal and were dropping mines in it at that time. We disembarked the next day. It was very hot in July, with our turn-up shorts and full kit and all the rest of it. And finally, we went on a train which moved very slowly, and in fact, unfortunately, about 1 o'clock in the morning, jumped the rails. Half the train was therefore allowed to go forward, and the other half followed 3 hours later with another locomotive. But we then got to a camp at a place called El Cassassin, which is Quassassein, I think, alongside the Sweetwater Canal. And that was to be our home for another month.
So you got there around about July 41.
That's right.
Till about August.
Yes, we were there about a month. And after a short time, we got orders, with priority orders for equipment on the depots. The quartermaster asked who was the last person to get this priority, and he said the New Zealanders who went to Crete. This was rather ominous, but our destination turned out to be Cyprus.
Now, before we go, had you taken your guns out with you, I presume, the 25-pounders, or the, not?
The whole of the equipment was shipped separately, being put on board at Avonmouth, and proceeded in entirely separate convoys, and was married up with us when we got to Egypt.
And what were conditions like at El Cassassim? I know you're only there a month, but it's quite a famous old camp, camp rather than old camp. Yeah. What was it like there?
Very large tents. It was. We were getting used to the heat of Egypt in this time of the year, and we really didn't do very much. We just sorted ourselves out and getting accustomed to the conditions.
And how did you find it yourself, the heat? I mean,
well, the one thing everybody had in the end was a water chatty, which is a porcelain type container for water, and which, because it evaporates slightly through it, it also cools the water. everybody acquired one of these.
So nothing much happened at El Kassi, but then you found you were on your way to Cyprus.
Yes, the theory was that Cyprus might be the next German target after they'd taken Crete. In point of fact, this didn't happen. But we moved to Cyprus with our full equipment, and the regiment moved to Nicosia, and we were there until early November.
So from August to November, roughly speaking.
That's right.
Now, what was the setup at Nicosia? Where were you based at Nicosia?
Well, we were under canvas, and taking the lessons from Crete, they made a very rough track a few miles out from the centre of Nicosia airfield, circumscribing 360 degrees. And the theory was that the artillery guns could move round this, would not be in any way hampered by having to go through Nicosia, and could fire on any invading parachutists trying to launch an attack, as was launched in Crete.
And who was actually building that? So that was that your men or?
We built just level things, divisional engineers and so on. It was just a rough track. And there were three aircraft on Nicosia airfield, three Hurricanes, and their orders were to fly back to the mainland if any hostilities broke out. However, none of this transpired.
What was like? Did you get on well with the Greek Cypriots or Turkish Cypriots? I'm not sure which area it is.
Well, it's at that time everybody was in harmony. We thought it was an ideal place to be. It had all the Mediterranean fruits, but not in the top quality, perhaps, of Palestine, and was a very pleasant place, and the population seemed to be on very good terms with themselves.
So it was an enjoyable period. It was. In many ways for you.
It was.
So what next?
Well, we then received orders to leave Cyprus, and we were being relieved by troops of the 5th Indian Division. Because air cover didn't extend to Cyprus, the changeover had to be done at night, and we had to leave all our equipment and only take light arms we could carry and cooking utensils. And we went down to the port at Famagusta, and the incoming troops were brought by ships of the Navy. The changeover took place about 1 o'clock in the morning. Their troops came off, our troops went on, and then we were back to Haifa and disembarking there. The result of this was a very bad deal for us. We lost all our splendid equipment we'd brought with us, and we had to literally re-equip in a fortnight in a camp just north of Haifa. The quartermasters nearly went mad. The equipment that we were handed over from 5th Indian Division had been to Keren and back and was in a pretty dilapidated state. 50% of it was condemned and replaced by mostly American-built equipment. And the whole job of re-equipment had to be done in a fortnight. This was then completed, and we set off from Haifa with orders to go to Iraq.